Today on Vox Talks Economics, preparing for the future of work, if there is one. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name's Tim Phillips, and every week we bring you the best new research in economics. So remember to subscribe and follow us on Instagram as well. As intelligent, autonomous machines become better at doing all of our jobs, will there be enough work and income to go around? And if only some of us are working, who's that going to be? And what's going to happen to the rest of us? Anton Korinek of the Brookings Institution and the University of Virginia is one of the authors of a CEPR discussion paper that examines these important questions, and he joins me now. Anton, welcome back. Good to speak to you again.
Hey, Tim. It's great to be back in your studio.
Anton, we've been here before. Every technology innovation leads to a discussion over the end of work, and somehow it never seems to happen. So why do you think this time's different?
Yeah, that's really the key question in this whole debate on technology and labor. If we look at the past 250 years, you're absolutely right that the effects of technological progress have been pretty amazing. They have been good for the vast majority of humanity. But if we zoom out a little bit and we look at the time before the Industrial Revolution, it doesn't look quite as rosy. The majority of people just lived a life of subsistence farming. And also, if we zoom in a little bit more into, let's say, the last 40 years of the Industrial Revolution, what you can see is that technological progress hasn't benefited everybody. It has left some behind. There were these phenomena of skill-based technological progress that in recent decades, only most highly skilled workers have really benefited from progress, and progress hasn't been all that rosy. So in our paper, we make the case that artificial intelligence could be quite different from what we have experienced since the Industrial Revolution. Neuroscientists tell us that our human brain is essentially a computation device. It takes in inputs and it spits out outputs. So if our brain is a computation device and we are developing these ever fancier artificial computer, then I think it's not a big jump to suppose that at some point the artificial intelligences can reach the same level of capabilities that our human intelligence can perform, and that at some point our human labor may indeed be redundant.
That chilling phrase you use in the paper, that we may be economically redundant, All of us. But how soon do you think this is going to happen? Do you think it's, well, I assume it's not months, but is it sort of years or decades or centuries? How quick?
I'll refer to people who know more about this than I do as an economist. And if you look at surveys of AI researchers, they generally think that this may happen around 2050, 2065 or something like that. And some people think it could even happen, say, by 2029. I think Elon Musk tweeted out something like that recently. The majority of AI researchers would think that it is possible at some point and likely in our current century. And I, as an economist, I think that that would really make it prudent and reasonable to prepare for what's going to happen on the economic side of things if we really develop those types of capabilities for artificial intelligence.
But there is, as you say, this wide range of opinion.
Indeed.
Not unusual to find Elon Musk at the extreme end of the wide range of opinion.
Right.
But one thing that the researchers generally do agree on is that at the moment, artificial intelligences are not good at some things that are very important for work. Mm-hmm. Negotiation, creativity, empathy. Are you arguing that it's only a matter of time until these problems are solved?
Essentially, yes. So Let's talk about negotiation first. In order to be good at negotiating, what you need is you need a good model of the human mind. To us humans, that comes naturally because we can just introspect and we can think, how would we feel if we were on the other side of the table? Now, obviously, machines can't do that because they are built completely differently. So it's going to take some time to develop machines that can essentially develop something like an effective model of the human mind. But, you know, let me maybe add a footnote of that. In some domains, we already have AI systems that understand our human mind perhaps better than we do ourselves. So let's say, for example, if you use social media or Twitter and you open the page and it serves you with something where you're like, wow, how did it know that I'm going to be really interested in this question? I haven't really followed this person. I have never liked a post by them. How did it know to serve me precisely this thing? That shows us that these AI-based recommendation models underlying our modern social media engines, they're really powerful. I would call them narrow superintelligences.
There will be a long period along this path during which there is work, just not enough of it to go around. Not everybody will have jobs. So during this time, who are going to be the people who are working? Is it going to be the people who are the most productive, which I guess is best for the economy, or is it going to be the people that enjoy the work the most, which I guess will be best for them? How do we decide on that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the way that I expect this to happen is that at some point when our AI systems are close to reaching basically human-like levels of intelligence across a wide swath of applications, the demand for labor is going to decline, and it's going to decline more and more as these systems get rolled out throughout the economy. And again, as you emphasized, we are not there right now. Right now, labor demand in most advanced countries is perhaps higher than it's ever been, and we have shortages everywhere. But maybe if we believe Elon Musk, in a decade, or if we believe the rest of the crowd, in 2 or 3 or 4 decades, we will reach that point. And yeah, who should it be who should be employed? Well, you know, I am an economist, so I do believe that the market has a useful role to play in that question. And as you say, there are kind of 2 important forces that will drive the answer. One of the categories of people you mentioned was people who are best at their jobs, or we economists would say who have very high labor productivity. Yeah. And for those, it would be natural to be employed by the economy. And of course, if they're very productive, the market is going to still pay them a higher wage than the others. So that would be the market force that would make sure that that category of workers will remain employed longer than those who are less productive. And then the second category of people who really like their jobs, who are really enjoying it, they would, of course, also still continue to work, because if you really enjoy it, and that's an important footnote, your material needs are somehow taken care of, you would continue to do work. I guess in some ways, volunteering falls into this type of work, even in our present days.
But say I wanted to just carry on doing the job I've always done, and it turns out that there's an artificial intelligence around that is better at this than I am. And I can accept that, but I just really want to keep doing it. Should I be allowed to work, or is someone going to stop me?
I would say absolutely you should be allowed to continue to work, because that's just a basic principle of freedom, freedom of choice. Now, what the market may tell you is if the artificial intelligence can do it so much better than you, you will earn only a pittance. Oh. And that means you may not take home a lot of pay, but nobody should prevent you from still doing it.
Well, that's good to know. But who's going to make up my income then? Where do I get income from if I'm not working or effectively volunteering?
Yeah, and that's going to be the fundamental challenge of economic governance. So if we didn't do anything and we just let this happen, and let's say we didn't have any social safety nets, then this type of redundancy of labor, basically a huge decline in the demand for labor, it would lead to mass misery. And of course, that's something that I think pretty much anybody would find desirable to avoid. So that means when I write about preparing for the non-existent future of work in our paper, I think we really need to prepare to have institutions that will provide for people's essential needs, and ideally more than the essential needs, that will provide for people to feel reasonably wealthy and to live happy and fulfilled lives. Otherwise, it would be a colossal failure of public policy. And if I may add, I think one of the amazing things is, right now, labor is in some sense the scarcest factor of the economy. Mm-hmm. Labor is what's holding back the economy from growing. And I guess nowadays you can even hear that if you talk to entrepreneurs, everybody is looking for workers. If we had more workers, we could produce more, our economy could be much wealthier, and so on. Now, the amazing thing is, if machines can do all the work, the economy can just explode in size. It could produce so much more, and it could make us all so much wealthier. But of course, for all of us to benefit from that, we would need to make sure that this windfall, these gains from artificial intelligence, are also shared appropriately. So we could produce so much more. And the amazing thing is, even if we just redistribute a fraction of that so that everybody in the world benefits, we could all be a lot better off.
If you're enjoying this and you want to find out more about the future of work, check out two other episodes. Whatever Happened to the 15-Hour Workweek, featuring Nick Crafts, published in June 2021. Or The World Needs More Migrants, our conversation with Lance Pritchett. That's from November 2018.
Anton, it's amazing how quickly this conversation about universal basic income has moved from like a fringe thought experiment into something that we're actually talking about seriously as policy. But of course, one of the long-standing objections is it's extremely expensive. And we've got to think about where the government gets its money from in a workless future. It can't tax labor income anymore because there isn't any labor income to tax. So where does it replace that money?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Raising the funds to finance something like a universal basic income is going to be tremendously expensive. And I guess the countervailing force that I just mentioned is our economy may also just grow at a much faster rate, so that should make it a little bit easier to raise funds. But still, it's going to be a challenge. And that's also the reason why at this point in our economic development, we don't really see a universal basic income across the majority of the world. And I think at this point, it would also be too early because we still really need labor. And labor, as I said before, is still the scarcest economic factor that we have. We need to basically set up an institution that will allow us to pay a universal basic income or something like that to ideally all the citizens of the world, because we don't want people in poor countries to be left further behind just because we make amazing technological progress in advanced countries. And what we would want is that those institutions are programmed so that as the share of labor progressively declines, the universal basic income or other benefits that we would provide will automatically scale up.
But what are we taxing, though, Anton, to pay for that? Are we taxing wealth? Are we taxing consumption? Are we taxing the machines?
Yes, that's another key critical question. So, as you said, we can't tax labor anymore if there is no labor. And the big problem is that right now, all around the world, our fiscal systems rely mainly on the taxation of labor. So what else shall we tax? One of the big problems is that we don't want to distort the incentives for the accumulation of machines, the incentives for further technological progress too much. And the best way around that is to spread our taxes across many different things so that everything that we tax isn't distorted too much. There are a few things that we can tax almost for free in the sense that taxing them doesn't introduce distortions. So for example, if we tax environmental pollution, we are actually offsetting a negative externality, and that doesn't distort things, that improves the allocation of resources. Then another thing, if we tax land, we don't actually distort anything because we won't change people's incentives to build more land or not, because land is there no matter what. So land taxes or taxes on other factors in fixed supply are a way of raising revenue without incurring too big of a distortion. The third point that I will mention is if we raise taxes on other types of rents, for example, monopoly rents, then that will also be relatively undistortive.
Now, work also has a social function. We, generally speaking, all agree that equality of opportunity is a good thing. Well, most people do. But then that leads to a certain amount of inequality, because people who work hard, people who work well, are rewarded more. And again, most people would agree that that's not a bad thing in society. Now, if work is replaced by a standard universal basic income, that changes. Is that a good thing?
Yeah, that's a big question. I think in most Western countries, we do have a societal agreement that some degree of inequality is okay if it is the result of ingenuity, hard work. I should mention almost always it is also the result of luck, even though those who were lucky do not always want to admit that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think there is also a sense across most of our societies that the inequality we have ended up with in the past couple decades is probably a bit excessive. Now, at least some of that inequality does actually not derive from different labor income, but it derives from capital income, from inheritances, from entrepreneurship, and so on. So I think there is a big risk that in a world without work, that type of inequality may take on a larger and larger role, because as you say, we won't have inequality based on different job opportunities anymore. And in some ways, I don't think it will be a radically different world from what we have today, because even today, the top 0.01% are not there because of their work, but they are there because of the companies that they started or inherited.
Now, Anton, I remember a couple of years ago, I interviewed Lant Pritchett, a development economist who has very strong and some quite unusual views. And his argument was that we shouldn't be thinking about cutting migration. It should be five times higher, because there are billions of people in the global south looking for work, prepared to work really hard. And yet in high income countries, we're creating machines to replace the jobs that they would really like to do. He thought this was immoral. Now, if we are looking for a workless future, is it going to be possible to give a universal basic income to people who were unlucky enough to be born in low-income countries as well?
So my personal hope is, yes, we will be able to do that. And it's based on this notion that we will be able to produce so much more output that I hope we can also distribute some of that to the global south. But I agree with you and with Lant that that's going to be a tremendous challenge. It's going to be hard to develop institutions that provide for the basic needs of all the citizens of advanced countries, and even more so to provide for the needs of people in developing countries who may also be put out of work by these machines that we in the advanced countries are developing. So yeah, it's going to be a tremendous challenge, but I do hope that we'll be able to meet it. I should also mention a universal basic income is not the only way that this can work out. What I discuss in the paper is that one alternative would be to make sure that capital ownership is distributed in a more equitable way, that, let's say, every citizen of the world gets ownership in a fund that contains some fraction of the largest corporations that are developing these types of AI systems. And then yet another possibility may be that we have these multi-trillionaires who have developed AI, and that they would engage in sufficient philanthropy to make sure that the basic needs of everybody around the world are taken care of.
I'm sure Elon Musk imagines himself as one of those multi-trillionaires, doesn't he?
Would not be surprised.
These are big ideas, Anton. Thank you very much for talking to me about them, because very often on Vox Talks, when we talk about the future, it's a very fearful conversation. And as you say, there are big problems, but also there's a thread of optimism and possibility that runs through this paper, which makes it a very interesting read. Thanks for talking about it today.
I'm glad to hear that, and thanks again for having me.
So you want to download this paper now. It's called Preparing for the Non-Existent Future of Work, and the authors Anton Korinek and Megan Jewels. It is discussion paper 17438. It's also a handbook chapter, I think, Anton. Is that correct?
That's right. It's forthcoming in the Oxford Handbook of AI Governance.
That might be an interesting handbook. Well, if it's all like this, it definitely will be.
I highly recommend it. I'm one of the editors, I have to add, in the interest of full disclosure.
This has been a Vox Talk from the Center for Economic Policy Research. We bring you the best new research in economics every week. So subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you're hearing, why not leave a review? Next time on Vox Talks Economics, the hunt for the world's ghost firms, and for the businesses that use them to cheat on their taxes.